Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Keel, and today I'm excited to welcome Brad Johnson, co-founder and CIO of Vintage Capital. Brad specializes in mobile home park investments and has over 20 years of experience with more than $3.3 billion worth of real estate transactions under his belt. He's been a mobile home park operator, an active operator, and now he is a capital allocator working in the mobile home park space. He also hosts his own podcast, the Alternative Investor Podcast, sharing strategies for alternative real estate and tax-advantaged investing. Brad, welcome to the show.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me today.
You bet, man. Would you mind, Brad, just starting out by sharing a little of your story and how in the world you got into mobile home parks?
Yeah. So I randomly came across a guy, I want to say when I was in my 20s, who he was a guy in Costa Mesa that owned a limo company. He owned hotels and he told me he owned residential community housing, which I was like, what is that? Right. And he was a pretty flashy guy. And so I'm like, well, that guy seems to know what he's doing. And I offered to kind of help him with his business and like do some financial analysis work, because that's how I kind of got into this space. Is I was, you know, I was the math guy, I was an analyst, finance guy. And so then I figured out that he owned mobile home parks, right? That was his main business. And he had all these random other businesses that didn't make any money. Like the mobile home parks made the money. And that was making him a very wealthy person. And he was only like, I don't know, 32 or something like that. And so that was kind of like my first quick exposure to the space, but it always kind of stayed in the back of my mind. And then, you know, I got into, you know, more institutional real estate and started working for a real estate investment bank. And I would, you know, I'd come across these mobile home park loan portfolios and would notice that, you know, they were generating all these cash. These high cash flow yields, and yet they weren't, you know, they had these low default rates. So I was like, well, you know, this guy was on to something 10 years ago. And so that's when I realized that I wanted to get out of the institutional world. I was working investment banking hours. I just had my first kid and I was like, I have to do it now. If I don't do it now, I probably will never do it. And I didn't want to go to like try to raise money to go buy skyscrapers, which is, you know, what I was working on. I was working on these large deals. I was like, who is going to give me, you know, all this money as a first-time operator if I just go try to do something that, you know, a bunch of other people with bigger, you know, resumes and longer track records have already done. I figured I needed to do something kind of niche-y. And I also am very obsessed with the downside. So I was like, well, this feels about right. And so that's what I did. I jumped in feet first and started buying parks, and I mean, frankly, didn't know what the heck I was doing, but figured it out along the way.
That's so awesome. Yeah. For at one point there, I thought you were going to say that you were like a Ryan Reynolds lookalike, you know, in LA or some sort of actor. Because man, yeah. I'm telling you, you and Ryan Reynolds, I'm telling you, you got similarities there.
Well, but, well, thank you. I should have sent you some money before this. Yeah.
But that's really awesome. Yeah, everybody's story of how they found mobile home parks is quite unique. Brad, if you could go back and tell yourself like one piece of advice about mobile home park investing before you got started, before you dove in, what would that one piece of advice be?
Yeah, I hate to change anything because I'm super thrilled with where I've ended up. And, you know, butterfly effect, you change one little thing, you might not be in the location today. But in the spirit of your question, I will answer. I would pay up for talent faster, right? I think everybody falls into this trap of like when you're trying to bootstrap a company, there's this period of time where it's like you're doing way too much as the entrepreneur. Like I started doing like AppFolio. I was doing the bookkeeping, you know, the tenant statements. I was doing everything because I wanted to learn how to do it so then I could manage people, right? Mm-hmm. And know what the heck they were talking about. But we got to the point where we had a fair amount of properties and was time to hire, but we were still thinking in this like lean, we're going to try to get the best value we can. And, you know, the sooner you can actually pay for A players, like the faster your business is going to go and the fewer headaches you are going to have. So if I had to go back, I think, yeah, quality is kind of my overarching screen today for any investment and for my own companies. You know, quality first, right? And you got to pay up for quality. And that's not only in terms of talent and staffing, but I would also apply that to the assets. Yes. Yeah. I think it's easy to fall in love with the model, right? It's really easy to say, oh yeah, 20 IRR, like, or today, you know, maybe it's a 17 IRR or whatever. And you're like, this is unreal. Like, I don't care what the property looks like. You know, we're going to do this deal because the numbers make sense and, you know, it's going to be a great return. But like the reality is that, you know, you just have fewer headaches and fewer big surprises with quality.
Literally an hour ago, I was talking to our largest investor and he was like, we hadn't spoken in a little while. And he says, hey, you know, what's your strategy now? What are you going after? I said, hey, quality and better markets is what the last 10 years has taught me, because in the better markets, there's very little turnover, if any at all. The homes basically sell themselves. Yeah. And the management, before we started recording, we were talking about how the management is one of the toughest parts of owning mobile home parks.
100%.
When you have parks in good areas, they require very little management compared to some of the other ones that are in more tertiary markets that have constant turnover and churn, and it's just a lot more to manage. So that's really good advice.
It's one of those decisions that like solves five other things down the stream, right?
Yes.
I would actually tweak it in that something has to be high quality. Like you can actually stretch the market a little bit if it is by far and away the nicest park, you know, within an hour, right?
Sure.
Because the thesis is still so, you know, so powerful, but something's got to be quality, right? Either the market or the, you know, the by far the best infrastructure and park out of a lot of other options. Like something has to be extremely high quality.
Yeah. Take us back to your first deal, Brad. The first deal you did, what did you learn from it?
I'll start with the first deal that I didn't do. The first deal I put under contract was the deal that got away. I still am bummed about it. It was a deal in a great market, Michigan, where we had this thing that was kind of 50% occupied, but a newer development. They just they couldn't infill it because of 2008 credit crisis hit, and they never finished the business plan. But it was very clear that we could infill it, you know, within a year or two. Anyways, it was only $1 million for like, I want to say it was like 50 pads or something like that, but like extremely good quality infrastructure. So we had the thing tied up and like we were 2 weeks from closing. I had spent a lot of personal capital. My partner had spent a lot of personal capital and diligence. And then the lender was like, we need 2 more weeks, you know, for closing. And so I called up the seller and explain this. And he proceeded to say, go pound sand. I have a $1.5 million offer now. Uh-huh. So it wouldn't give us the time. And I kind of learned a painful lesson about, you know, dealing with lenders and putting in a lot of different contingencies into my contracts and making sure that there was a lot of, you kind of thought through every different angle. So that was kind of the first major lesson in this space. And then, you know, I kind of parlayed that to, you know, just, okay, well, look, the next one hopefully will work out. And thankfully, the next one was seller financing, you know, but I had a bunch of extensions in that contract, right? And things did pop up. And had I not learned the lessons from the first one, we wouldn't have closed the second one. So anyways, it's your first one never goes to plan is kind of what I tell people is like, expect to get screwed somehow on the first one, either as the GP on your returns, the seller might do something. Just assume that it's not going to go perfect to plan, but just keep going. It's kind of what I tell people who are just getting into the space.
That's good.
Yeah.
Tell us about like your capital allocation business and how do you decide which operators to trust, you know, before you make an investment?
Yeah. Well, the allocation side of the business is really kind of zooming back and solving for what I wanted, you know, my life to look like and something that I could do for the next, you know, 30, 40 years in the space. Because I'm an investor at heart. I am not a boots on the ground operator. That's, you know, I ended up having to do that. I built that company, sold that portfolio around COVID. Great outcome. But I didn't want to go ahead and then rebuild that company again and be, you know, in the weeds with property management. I wanted to be able to kind of zoom out and look at the markets that I wanted to be in long term and diversify not only market, but sponsor risk. And so, you know, it's been great. Been able to take the lessons of an operator and the network and leverage both of those things with investor base and, you know, get to put a lot of capital to work in a really diversified way where I don't have to kind of worry about, you know, one asset causing any damage long term to my portfolio or our investors' portfolios that are investing with multiple deals. But for, as far as selecting an operator, it, you know, it's kind of an art. It's a lot easier having been an operator myself because you can't really, you know, you can't pull the wool over my eyes. Like it, I can kind of answer the questions or ask the questions. I'm like, you know, how detailed is your operating platform? How detailed are your systems? Like how dialed are you from a team standpoint? There's a lot of, you know, two guys in a deck type of operators in this space that kind of just fell in love with the thesis. And look, I don't blame them. Like that was, that's how I got started, right? That was our first deck. But the reality is that it's not the same environment that it was 12 years ago. You do not get to just ride the wave of cap rate compression. Mm-hmm. You don't get to just hope that, you know, interest rates decline are going to bail you out or that you're buying into this secret asset class that people haven't caught wind yet of, right? Mm-hmm. It's like today is it is a pros market, as you know. And so if you don't have the operational chops, if you can't like go in the weeds on your system, your platform, how you run deals, like what is your edge? What's your operational alpha? If you can't explain that clearly to me, then I kind of know like, okay, you're not quite ready yet, but we want to track you. We want to see how you do. We want to help you grow. We want to help you build your business. You know, maybe we'll catch you next year, right? When you're there. Because I just know that, you know, if you're trying to buy something from 2,000 miles away and you're like, yeah, I'm going to be there all the time. We're going to infill 50 homes. And no, we don't have a home sales team. And we're going to use just the cash program for 21st Mortgage. They're going to do them all. They're going to move in 12 a month. And no, yeah, we're just going to hire somebody on site we're going to pay them $15 an hour. They're going to handle home sales. They're going to handle property management, collection. Yeah. And maybe maintenance too, right? It's like, okay, well, we know that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's helpful. And like I've seen, you know, I invested with 15 different sponsors at this point, not only as a limited partner, but also as a general partner, co-GP with them, and have stood up two platforms where groups have been able to kind of go from, hey, maybe they have 10 parks and they want to bring in a large private equity company where we'll help them get to, you know, 3x that portfolio within a couple of years. And so, you know, I've seen a lot and I've kind of got a sense of the different flavors of how people build their businesses and how they staff them. And then you got to kind of match that.
Let's go in the weeds. I think that's really interesting, like the different types of operators and the different flavors like you're talking about. Like, I think there's, you know, a lot of investors, they get started and they're like, okay, we're going after heavy value add, you know, 50% vacant parks. And then, you know, after a few years, they kind of change that criteria of the different types of parks they're going after. And then, you know, they kind of graduate to better markets, institutional quality sure. assets. Maybe you can just touch base on that. Like, you know, what's the sweet spot?
Yeah. So a lot of groups do graduate to that, right? They kind of realize that, hey, we can only run so many value add parks, even though the value add parks generate the highest returns, generally speaking, especially if there's infill or some hair on it. And so a lot of groups decide that they do the calculus on like a time adjusted IRR, right? Or I always think of it as like a hassle adjusted or a headache adjusted, you know, IRR as opposed to a risk adjusted return. And so they realized that, well, look, we're just going to be better off from a whole, you know, a company standpoint if we focus on maybe light value add or stabilized parks that earn, you know, a 12, 13% return, but we're not having to like dedicate so much time and effort to it and staff around it. Whereas, you know, I like those deals. Those are, I think of those as core plus deals. Those are the equivalent of the fixed income, you know, the bond lower risk deals in our portfolio. But I love sprinkling in, you know, the heavier value add stuff as well, right? Because that you don't have to be reliant so much on the market. You can kind of just drive returns yourself. You don't have to be as reliant on the debt terms you're going to get at refinance or where they're at exit. You can literally, you know, triple the NOI. And so the groups that focus on that, I think, just are very good at, you know, pairing up home infill, right? Like construction capabilities and home sales with their property management. So everyone throws around, oh yeah, we're vertically integrated. But usually that just means that like we have an asset management arm and a property management arm, right? Like vertical integration in our industry is like soup to nuts. Like we buy the home, we're a dealer, we can move the home, we can install the home, we can maintain the home, we can property manage the home, right? It's like literally everything. And there's very few groups that have all of that because it takes time to build that. It takes skill. And, you know, it's just a lot, right? And it's not everybody, like, especially finance guys, like, it took me a long time to get to the point where I could oversee or like knew what I was even looking at from a construction management standpoint on, you know, an infrastructure project or a big infill type of park. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I think about it. It's a spectrum. There's a middle ground, which is, you know, light infill or guys that are just able to buy stuff that's so off market, or maybe they have a thesis about a market that, you know, that is a little bit on the edge where a lot of groups are like, oh, you know, I'm not going to Alabama, but they're like, no, like seriously, this market is booming. And so that they can get an edge there. They get, you know, a lower basis. And so that's a value add, but it's a lower risk value add than obviously bringing in 100 homes, which,
sure,
you know, we've invested in parks that have done that, which is awesome, but it's
very hard to do.
It's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot.
And maybe tell me like some of your best investments and what did they do right? And then, you know, maybe talk about some of the ones that didn't go well, right? That didn't perform as expected and what went wrong and like how we can all learn from those.
Yeah. The best ones have been really, they bought it right. They didn't get like the steal of a century, but they bought it right. It's a reasonable purchase. Mm-hmm. And then they were able to, lots of times they have seller financing, right? Because there was some sort of quirk to it where it wasn't generating enough revenue for a traditional bank to put a decent sized loan on it. And therefore the buyer pool was constrained, right? And so they were able to get a reasonable deal. And then they come in and they don't double the rent, right? They do it in a thoughtful, sustainable manner, in addition to a big capital push, right? So usually it's, you know, they're improving the roads, they're bringing in homes, like they're showing the tenants that, hey, look, we're investing in this park. Like there's a new sheriff in town, like we are going to improve collections, but we're also going to give you something in exchange for, you know, the more intensive property management and perhaps a 15% lot rent increase. And so I always say it's, you know, it's really not like the value of this space is not the ability to take rents double or 50% within 1 to 2 years, which some groups, you know, unfortunately have done and gotten a bad reputation in the space. The opportunity in this space is really the ability to raise rents in a repeatable way year in and year out for a very long time. And because you just do not see that in any other asset class. You cannot underwrite 10 years of rent increase in any other asset class, except probably mobile home parks, right? If you're buying it in a reasonable market with a fair amount of cushion to where apartment rents are. So yeah, the guys that have just crushed it, they didn't do anything heroic. They just like did the basics very well, but they took something that was like kind of underperforming in a reasonable good market. And then they just put in professional systems and they set a brand new, you know, standard for the tenants, and then kind of infilled on the edges and just did all the right things, right? They didn't do anything spectacular. But that's generally been the best outcomes. It's been in the above average markets, where they're kind of taking something that's 80% to 100%, right?
Yeah. So it's not 20% to 100%, right? It's not the major ones. It's just the 80, that top little cushion there. That's
the giant ones. Like we're hopefully selling next year a giant, like take it from 30% occupied to 95% occupied, but it's in the Southeast. It requires a ton of park owned homes. It's literally 100 home infill. Like it's going to be a great outcome, but you hear that you think, oh, that's got to be a 5X. Like, no, it'll probably be like a 2X return. Now I would argue that is, you know, assuming you have that team in place that has all those skills that I talked about, that's probably, you know, you don't have to rely on exit caps, right? It's like, no, we moved NOI that dramatically that, you know, it's maybe a higher probability that they were going to even pull that off versus some guys that, you know, think that they can kind of turn around a park in a struggling market just with lot rent increases. But, you know, it's not going to be a 5X. Like it's that's a lot of time and effort and a lot of capital in those park owned homes to bring in for a 2X. But it's a 2X in like 3 years. So it's still pretty good.
Still pretty great. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
How important is it to you that an operator has their own money in the deal?
You know, that's interesting because this space, for whatever reason, that's not as big of a convention. It's certainly a big positive to me. But like, you know, you go to other asset classes and it's kind of just assumed somebody's going to put in 3 to 10%. The GP is going to put that much capital in. So I always like to see it, but I will take it in other forms. Like I will take skin in the game in other forms. Like if you're going to sign for homes, like there's some infill component, you're going to sign the personal guarantee for the homes. Maybe you're going to have to sign a personal guarantee on the loan because it's a balance sheet loan versus Fannie or CMBS. That to me is skin in the game. Like that person, like if you sign personally, you are committed to making sure that deal doesn't go south, right? So there's other forms, but you know, I tend to think because I know the assets pretty well, right? That I'm more comfortable like going with an emerging manager that maybe they don't have the cash yet to be able to write a big co-investment. Whereas, you know, some other asset classes that I just invest as an LP, I would not do that. I would only do it if they were writing a big check because I just don't know the asset class as well. Sure. You know what I mean? So
Yeah, it's a little different. This is interesting. How do you verify whether the operator is truly executing on their business plan? You have like a way of doing that for deals in progress?
Yeah, you really are dependent on reporting. Sometimes we'll do like, you know, secret shopping, right? We'll just go, you know, have somebody drive the park, but it really is reporting. And, you know, it's also just the distributions that are showing up are the first canary in the coal mine, obviously. It's keeping good records, right? It's like, okay, we have the underwriting initially that they did. We have our version. And now we're year three, like, where are we at? Like, where are we at versus expectations? So, I mean, thankfully, like because the asset class is so strong, like 80% of operators are pretty close to the initial business plans, which, I mean, compare that to apartment buildings. I mean the spectrum, the variance of outcomes is insane for apartments, including just full write-offs, losses. Very, very few in the overall industry of manufactured housing, there have been very few complete losses unless there was some sort of weather event. We haven't had one yet with existing deals. And, you know, so I don't know. I think thankfully people picked the right asset class, I think, in this space, right?
Yeah.
And therefore that the outcomes are a little bit tighter in terms of the dispersion.
Yeah. We haven't either, you know, doing over 53 deals and I don't think I know
that's
anybody.
That's either. Fantastic. Yeah, you know that's I mean? Fantastic. Like, yeah.
So I think there's something to be said there about the asset class.
But if you're in the asset class long enough, you are going to have a zero. Like something is going to happen. Like it's going, like you do 100 deals, it's highly likely just out of, you know, bad
hurricane,
luck. A hurricane,
tornado,
a flood.
Something.
Yeah. Something. Like I had one. So I had one that was a complete loss, but it was in a fund. So the investors were totally fine. Thankfully, there was 12 assets in the property, but I had a park that flooded.
Oh, geez.
And it was brutal. So I always tell investors, like, look, if you invest in this space in a diversified way, really hard to lose money. You almost actively have to try to lose the investor money by doing dumb things like over-leveraging things. But yeah, I had a park that flooded, and
was it like even in this, a flood way, like a flood zone, or it wasn't even in the FEMA flood map?
It was kind of a freak thing. It was right next to a river, which I'm very nervous about rivers, even if it's not in flood zones. But it was in upstate New York, which is another, I'm not doing New York anymore for a different reason. Yeah. Which we can talk about, but yeah, it had an ice jam. So the river froze and it created, it's like its own little dam. So the water couldn't get through and it just started pouring into the park. Yeah. So it was crazy. Like the state gave us, they said they were going to give us $7 million worth of homes to replace all the homes that got damaged. It ended up being three, but that was still amazing. Wow. But even with that help, like, you know, we were able to get people back in their homes, which I feel so grateful that we did that. And it was an insane amount of work for no return, right? We lost money, lost a lot of money. But thankfully, like I said, it was in a fund. It's in a diversified way or diversified investment. And that's why I always recommend to people, it's like, unless you're writing 5 to 10 checks into different properties, you probably should be in some sort of fund structure. Like, I just don't like the guy, you know, the investor who doesn't know what they're doing, who gives somebody $50,000 or $100,000 and that's their only private investment. Mm. I have a hard time with that. I'm like, well, you probably should have just put that money in the stock market. So, you know, I think people should invest either over a series of deals, right, to get a little bit of spread out, because you just never know. I mean, your record of 50 and not having a loss is unreal, but that's, you know, just pure math, you would think something would happen at some point, weather-wise.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Let me ask you this, Brad. What advice would you give a new passive investor considering their first mobile home park deal? Like, you just gave some advice there. You'd recommend the fund over the individual syndications. But is there something else, you know, on what you would look at or what you would recommend if someone's going to put, say, $100,000 into a mobile home park deal? You know, what should they look at? What are like the top things they should look at?
Sorry, are they buying a park themselves with a couple of people and they're going to run it? Or are they investing as a limited partner?
They're as a limited partner, going to be investing as a limited partner.
Yeah, I mean, I feel bad for emerging managers because it's such an uphill climb, right? And you and I were both emerging managers at one point.
Yeah.
But that's tough, right? It's tough to do that, is like, if this money is super precious to you, which of course it is, right? So unless you're, once again, making 10 of these investments, I would probably go with somebody with a verified track record who has seen it all, right? And because, like, the reality is like, you get thrown so many crazy things in this business on a day-to-day basis that if you don't have a team, if you don't have real good systems, you don't have like a standard operating procedure for every little random thing that comes up, like, you can get sidetracked real quick. And if you don't have the ability to inject new capital into problem deals or raise new capital if you need to, like, you can lose a deal back to the lender, right? It can happen. It's not like it's the perfect asset class. It's operationally intensive. It's a good place to park money, certainly from a risk reward standpoint. But if you don't know what you're doing, it's also, you know, a pretty good place to lose money. So yeah, I would just go with track record, experience. Ideally, you'd want, you know, experience in that market or region, because there's, as you know, there's quirks, right? Mm-hmm. To each different region, each different city has different regulations, or state rather.
And let's talk about that real quick. Which regions have you had the best success rates with?
The biggest returners have probably been in the Southeast and the Midwest. The Midwest, I feel like you have to really pick your spots, though, because we kind of talked about, like, you know, just because the thesis is so great doesn't mean you can go to some, you know, no person town. Yeah. Because even if it's a 100,000 person town or whatever, if incomes aren't there, like, it doesn't matter how affordable your lot rent is relative to the two bedroom. They're just the incomes aren't there.
The hard way. Yeah. We bought a deal in Keokuk, Iowa, if you know where that is.
Yeah.
Like Southeast Iowa.
Yeah. I do know where that is.
It was the first park we sold, thankfully, back in, we had really good timing of when we sold it, but But yeah, it was just a really bad market and no one had $1,500 to put down as a down payment for an RTO. So it was like, if you don't have that, like it's a really just depressed market and really just low quality, you know, people to choose from a tenant based standpoint. It just makes everything else harder, you know, higher turnover, just higher risk. So I agree. Yeah, there's still markets that you can, you know, have issues with.
Yeah, even though everything else looks great. And then the real problem in those kind of markets is, you know, especially if there's a park-owned home component. I mean, that's like the circle of death, right? If you get a newer operator that raises just barely enough money to kind of close the deal and take their acquisition fee, right? And then they're in a market like that that is a little soft with maybe there's only 10% park-owned homes or 20%. So they feel, okay, this seems reasonable. But then you get that turnover when you start trying to do things like enforce rules or, you know, enforce collections. And then those tenants leave and then you realize, oh, that home needs a lot of money, right? And then the tenant base isn't as good. So the next renter or, you know, mistreats the home again. So that's a great way to kind of just circle the drain. And so I would also tell newer LPs, they probably should for their first one, like I would just go to easy mode just to get exposure to it. I would probably avoid the parks with a lot of park-owned homes with complicated private utilities, right? Like I don't mind septic. I used to just, literally I did in my first portfolio where I was the property manager, everything was city water, city sewer. Because I didn't know enough and was nervous about risk. I like sleeping at night. So like the thought of like a treatment plant or even septic at that time, or God forbid a lagoon, was just like, you know, no, thank you. Life's too short. Yeah. Whereas over time, especially now that I'm not the one dealing with the issues day to day, I think septic is just fine if you have enough space. But if I was newer to the space, I would kind of avoid those type of parks too. Like, for example, I just got pitched a deal where, you know, everything looked great, except it's a treatment plant. And it's a treatment plant on like a $4 million deal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if that treatment plant fails, that's literally, you know, $1 million to $2 million. I mean, it's just not big enough. Yeah. That's a walk away scenario. Like if the deal's $10 million, $20 million, sure, that's fine. But yeah,
to this day, I'm with you. We have septics, we have wells, but I've never owned a treatment plant, never owned a lagoon.
Yeah.
Sewer. Just
don't do it.
They teach at the boot camp, the Frank and Dave boot camp, kind of stay away. And I've heard horror stories, you know, of those going bad. And one guy had a treatment plant in a barn and the barn burned down. And the treatment plant was like $1 million, like you said. And it was only like 70 lots. So like,
oh my God.
Yeah, you know, so there's just things that happen. You
got
to be.
Yeah. And then you got the state sending you scary letters, right? You got the, you know, the department environmental agencies sending you letters like, no thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was my least favorite thing is getting the surprise kind of letter from a state agency on some random thing. And most of the time it was nothing. It's fine. But, you know, those can be scary things. Yeah. So you just kind of want. You want pros. You want people that have seen it before. Like, because I always thought it was funny. Like, you'd hire a manager and you'd get these calls like Christmas Eve, like, you know, during the Super Bowl or something. Oh, man, everything's going to hell. Like, the whole park is underwater or, you know, the things are, we just got an agency that's, you know, they're going to close down the park. And then you kind of get in the weeds, you deal with it. And you're like, okay, it's not a crisis. We can deal with this. But generally speaking, when you're investing, it's like you want to go with the pros, at least early, until you know what kind of risk you're actually taking with an emerging manager. Like I've invested with plenty of emerging managers, which I like doing because especially somebody who's, you know, somebody who's 30, they could be investing in this space for 30 years. Like that is incredibly valuable to me, right? Because relationships compound, trust compounds. Right, the speed at which I can invest with them compounds, and so that is amazing when you can find them. But like, you got to, you know, be able to evaluate that team.
Sure,
and it's really hard to do if it's your first check.
Yeah, no, that's really good. Yeah, to build trust over time. Here's a little lightning round. I'm just gonna, whatever the first thing that comes to your mind, just spit it out. All right, there's just five questions.
All right, I'll try.
All right. If you could own every park in one state, which would it be?
North Carolina.
One state you would never buy another park in, and why?
New York. That's the easiest one, I think you'll ask me. Yeah, it was, you know, it was 3 years before we could evict somebody. You know, people just, tenants took advantage of it. That state is just very anti-landlord. It's just, it is. It's a fact. So, and it's tough to do business there on all fronts.
Yeah. The biggest mobile home park myth you would like to bust in one sentence?
That it is a cash cow. Yeah, that these are just cash cows. That mentality needs to get out of the marketplace, right? It's just like buying an apartment building. Like you're offering a product, you have to offer a good product, right? If you want to do this sustainably. And that's my whole thing. It's like, I don't like the 2-3 year transactions. I mean, they're great. I have participated in them. It's nice to get a check, but I dramatically prefer the longer term compounding in this space because of the benefits that we've talked about, especially the tax benefits. Mm. So I want to see people that do it in a sustainable way where they are taking care of the assets. They're reinvesting back into the parks. They're not optimizing for a yield day one. They're optimizing for kind of a steady state yield is how I think about it.
I was just at Reconvene out in California.
In
the woods.
Yeah.
And we got to talk with a guy named Avi. I forget his last name, but Charlie Munger invested with them to buy apartments. And he said that, you know, Charlie went to every single apartment complex. And that's one of the things he said that Charlie was always big on, is like reinvesting into the communities, into the parks, into the apartments. And, you know, it's very rare that you would see that, you know, he's like, one of the quotes he said was, profit is what comes after we take care of the apartment complex, right? Like they were the only people that were like planting trees and actually doing, you know, good improvements and stuff. And yeah, that long-term, everything they did was like 15-year, you know, fixed debt, long-term deals. I think there's not a lot of those out there. I think everybody kind of wants that quick flip, but there is a lot of value just holding these things long-term and just getting those annual rent increases up. So
yeah, it's just the right thing to do. And I think it's the right thing to do for that business model, right? Is when you're taking care of the tenants and the asset, like it's going to take care of you, right? From a cash flow standpoint, eventually. It might not be year one, but it's amazing how many problems you can avoid by both problem tenants and regulators by just doing kind of the right thing for the asset at the right time and having access to capital. That's the big thing that, you know, this industry kind of got into this, like, oh, these things just generate so much cash and I can buy these things on, you know, on a shoestring budget and I'll just buy like, or, you know, more homes or improve the facilities with cash flow. Right. And no, you have to have access to capital. Like this industry needs to get more institutional. Right. And you see it, you see the big private equity buyers coming into play, which, you know, has its own challenges, but long-term it's better that there's more capital being invested in the properties than not.
Definitely. I remember on my very first deal, I was going to use the cash flow to infill.
Yeah. And
thankfully the partner that I went to was like, no, let's just raise an amount upfront so you can utilize that. Otherwise it would have taken another 5 years, you know, because things inevitably went wrong that we didn't pro forma for. And, yeah, I think that's one mistake newer operators could make, is not raising enough money up front and just thinking, oh, well, the 21st mortgage program is going to handle the infill and I won't need to have any money out of pocket. I'm going to use the cash flow to do that. I think that's a really good point for the listeners.
Yeah. And I don't want to sound like, you know, like I'm coming down from the mountain, you know, and giving these lessons. Like I made all of these mistakes. Like I was the idiot who thought that, yeah, we can just let cash flow, like buy all the new homes and upgrade, you know, the roads, right? Like it's really short-term thinking because it's kind of optimizing for this cash flow yield, which, look, you can make a better return, right? If you just do some of these other things that reinvest in the park, then you can justify the rents. Then you can have occupancy higher faster.
Yeah.
But you just, you know, your 1-2 yield might not look that great.
Totally.
So I don't know. That's my soapbox.
When you hear mobile home park, what's the first image that pops into your head?
Honestly, it's the first park I bought, Cherry Woods in Kansas. And it's the image of it from above where it was a beautiful aerial. And I know that sounds weird, right? Because it's a mobile home park, and B, it's like this, whatever, it's 2D aerial of it. But the guy, his name is Randy Jackson, and Scott Jackson, who is pretty famous in this industry, it's his brother. Scott, we lost Scott a couple years ago, but Randy, I believe, is still with us. And he built this park, and he built it right. He did concrete roads, like all PVC, like literally every home was perfectly positioned geometrically within the park. And it just looks like I knew from the aerial that we weren't going to have any maintenance problems with the infrastructure, and we didn't have one. Like, we held it for 5 or 6 years, and yeah, not one problem with the infrastructure, because he just did it the right way. He was, you know, it's like the greatest generation. They were built a little differently. They just, they went for quality. They didn't cut corners, right?
Yeah.
So there goes back to my quality statement.
Awesome. Well, that was my last question, Brad. I really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, no, it's great to be here. It's always fun talking mobile home parks, especially with a pro.
Oh, yeah, I appreciate that. My wife is always glad when I can talk with someone else about the trailer parks with. But how can our listeners get in touch with you or learn more about what you're doing at Vintage Capital if they'd like to?
Yeah, they can go to vintage-funds.com, and we have a ton of resources. I'm a big believer in educating the space, because, you know, these properties need to be run the right way. And I think, you know, teaching people how to do it the right way is useful in that regard. Plus, we get to meet new operators that ultimately we'll probably invest with along the way. And if we can kind of help them do it a little bit better, that benefits us as well. So yeah, vintage-funds.com.
Awesome. That's it for today, folks. If you got value out of this episode, please consider leaving us a review. It really helps us get more listeners. And that's it for today. Thanks for tuning in.
Would you like to see mobile home park value add projects in progress? If so, follow us on Instagram at @passivemhpinvesting for photos and awesome videos from our recent mobile home park acquisitions. Once again, that's @passivemhpinvesting on Instagram. See you there.